because the federal government is taking, as we said before, an increasing amount of taxes out of the states. Some of that has to be turned to the states in the form of a tax-sharing program. The Congress is conscious of this. The federal officials are conscious of it. I think it's eventually going to work out.
Well, Vice President Agnew has been put in charge of federal-state relationships on the part of the Nixon administration. Have you talked to him at all about... You would seem to have a pipeline in there, albeit you're on opposite sides of the political fence. Have you talked to him or discussed the possibility of Maryland getting any more money?
Well, I've talked to Vice President Agnew about this very problem before he became vice president. In fact, before he had any thought of becoming vice president. And he recognizes the problem, and he still does. We had a meeting in Washington not so long ago of the 50 governors with the vice president, and this very question was discussed. It's fully recognized that there is a problem, and also recognized that something has to be done about it.
There's another, while we're on the subject of taxes, another thing has recently come up once again, the subject of commuter tax in the District of Columbia. In your opinion, is there any likelihood of a commuter tax being passed? The opposition which you've marshaled, and Virginia obviously has also, is it a real threat to Maryland?
No, I've discussed this at a meeting last week with our congressional delegation, and they told me that there is no question that there will not be a commuter's tax, that it was a dead issue at this time, and said it in no uncertain terms, and I accept that as being a fact.
You at one time had also said that you wouldn't like to have to impose, or I think it was more forceful than that, you would not impose a tax in retribution for it. Would you still stick by that if somehow the thing did get past Congress and Senate?
Well, I don't think that taxes imposed in retribution are the way to solve a problem. I think the way you solve it is go to the source and try to work out an arrangement or to work out an agreement. We have the same problem, for example, in Delaware. We have an income tax problem there because we impose an income tax. Delaware imposed an income tax. Some of the people could have been taxed twice. We managed to work something out there, though it isn't the best arrangement. Now, I don't think taxes passed in retribution are a good thing because it just brings on further problems.
There seems to be some increasing pressure outstate and all around the state, for that matter, but particularly in the suburbs of Washington, to talk about mortgage interest rates and to call a special session to do it. Builders like Jack Alfandre say there'll be another money crisis in the state of Maryland.
The lending institutions would do the same thing they did the last time. They would put their money in Virginia where they had no fear of violating a usury law. All of our money comes out of the District of Columbia lending institutions for home building, for houses, not commercial ventures. And if these people have a ready market by just going south instead of north, they'll go south instead of north and lend their money without any trouble. So we will have the same situation develop again here in suburban Maryland.
According to what the lenders say, it's getting pretty close to that right now. Are you considering a special session of the legislature?
Not at this moment. I'm not considering a special session. The question, of course, has arisen, and I've discussed it with numerous people who are familiar with this area. If it develops into a real crisis, we'll have to get into that a little later on. But let me say this. When this came up last year, the argument was made that Maryland had a 6% interest rate, Virginia was 8%, the District of Columbia was 8%, so that we had to equalize the interest rate in order to get this money back into Maryland. Well, we did. We went to 8%. Now the District of Columbia is 8%, so is Virginia. We're all the same. So that the crisis has to be developing from some other source other than the fact that the money is not available. And I think the crisis is emanating from the fact that mortgage brokers are not able in Maryland to earn as much on the brokerage of the money as they do in the other areas. And this is where we have the crisis.
Of course, they counter with the fact that Virginia and the District of Columbia have a higher ceiling or no ceiling at all, and therefore there is no pressure to keep the money down, and the money would stay down of its own accord, seek its own level, so to speak, if Maryland had no limit.
Well, Virginia and, let me say, Virginia and District of Columbia both have the same 8% interest ceiling that we have. The difference is that they allow the mortgage banks and mortgage brokers, and I don't say this derogatorily, it's a business and they serve a useful purpose, but they allow them to charge for the purpose of securing that money what we call points, or 1% or 2% or 3%, the same as calling it points. They allow them to make excess or make charges, maybe not excessive. Maryland limits the kind of charges that can be made for the purpose of securing loans, so that the mortgage broker cannot earn in Maryland the same kind of money that he could earn in Virginia and Washington. This is the problem.
Governor, if we could just switch briefly to consumer protection. I know that the legislature did take some steps in this direction to prosecute businessmen and before some damage has been done, but it did not adopt this uniform consumer credit code. Are you going to push for this again?
This is being studied right now. It's an involved law and has to be analyzed very carefully to fit it in with our laws generally. It just isn't something that you can adopt overnight. It's being studied and will be probably pursued at the next session of legislature.
Are you looking into any other areas of consumer protection?
Well, as you know, consumer protection has become a bigger and bigger problem all the time, but the federal government has gotten into it very vigorously, and so has the state. We have a division under our Attorney General's office that is being increased and is doing a good job, and I think that you've got to work with business in this area. You just can't adopt laws and say this is the final answer. You've got to have coordination with industry and business, with better business bureaus and that type of thing. This was worked out very well in the state, and I think our department's working out very well.
And one other point on this, State Insurance Commissioner Newton Steers has the job, of course, of watching the insurance companies that do business in the state of Maryland. Many say he's done quite a good job, but he doesn't believe you're going to reappoint him. Do you care to comment on that?
He's never discussed it with me, and quite frankly, I don't even know when his appointment expires, because he serves a term, and I've never looked into it. I've just accepted the fact that he is there and doing his job. Now that you've reminded me, I ought to check it.
switching to another thing, which is obviously sure to come up before the legislature again, is the subject of crime. And one glaring bill which failed to pass was the mandatory sentence for the use of gun in a crime that was presented by Mr. Wineland, I think. Why did this not pass? Did you agree with it or disagree with the bill?
I wasn't involved in that particular piece of legislation, but let me say this to you. Over the years, the history of mandatory sentencing has not shown that it really serves the purpose for which it was passed. Mandatory sentences have resulted in, for example, in the field of narcotics, there are certain mandatory sentences. The result is that you find that the courts become increasingly careful of convictions, knowing that they have to give a mandatory sentence in that particular area. So that we do have minimum sentences and we do have maximum sentences, and the judges today have all the power to impose these sentences once a man's been convicted. But mandatory sentences have not shown to be the answer.
But in some cases, they seem not to be imposing the sentences that they do have the power to impose. There seems to be growing social pressure, at least in some quarters, for stronger sentences, harsher sentences.
Well, I think that this is a question that could be debated quite vigorously. I think that one of the things that has resulted over the past few years is the fact that the courts have tended to become somewhat lenient because of what you term social pressures, and I think perhaps this has been a mistake. But this is something the judicial system will have to remedy, and I think they will.
Well, in line with this, I think that Mr. Greenhall, when he mentioned the fact that he thought Montgomery County had been slighted somewhat, was perhaps miffed at the fact that you had given money or offered money to Prince George's County to help in its fight against spillover crime from the district, but you hadn't given any to Montgomery County.
Well, let me tell you what happened. Prince George's County went to the federal government and asked for an appropriation of $250,000 because they were having an increasing crime rate that was resulting from people from Washington coming into Prince George's County and committing the crime, and it has become a serious problem. They vigorously pursued this in order to try to encourage the federal government to give us some help. I offered that the state would match the money that the federal government had offered. There was never a request for funds from Montgomery County.
Last year, there was some pretty strong opposition from the Eastern Shore and other outstate areas, and right here in the D.C. suburbs also. It led to the defeat of your proposed state constitution. One of the leaders of that fight, Sheriff William Kersey of Prince George's County, indicates that he and others will oppose the November attempt to accomplish constitutional revision through those amendments.
Speaking not only for myself, but for the Sheriff's Association of the State of Maryland, which I'm the president of, we really haven't had a great deal of time to study all the proposed amendments to the Constitution. I have had the opportunity in the last few days to go over them somewhat in detail. As I look at the proposals now, I think some of the opposition may be in the realignment of the executive branch. The opposition, I know, feel very strongly will probably come as far as the appointment of judges instead of an elected judge, as we now have in the judicial system in the state of Maryland.
Let's leave the executive branch for just a moment and talk about the latter point that he made, the election of the judges. Do you expect any hard opposition to the amendments on any points other than the elected judges provision?
I expect that there will be opposition. I think that there's a hard core of opposition that you'll find that no matter what proposals are presented. But I think the sheriff made the point very well. He hasn't had opportunity to examine the proposals. And I think once they're examined, you'll find that a great deal of the opposition will have a tendency to decrease. The proposals that were passed by the General Assembly were matters that, one, felt there was an urgent need, and two, that were almost non-controversial when the last constitutional revision attempt was made. There were matters that almost everyone, even the opponents, agreed on were necessary. The reason why they weren't passed is because you had to vote for a total package. Here, the people are given the opportunity to vote on the items one by one. I think most of them are just non-controversial.
Now, on the point of revision also, you have, what, 246 agencies currently, I think it is?
That's all that we've been able to find up to this point.
And the flowchart actually looks pretty imposing now on what you are proposing with how many cabinets is it, 10?
10. What we're trying to do is to bring some semblance of organization and order out of this myriad of departments, agencies, and commissions we have. You said 246, and this is correct. This is the ones that we have found in our state departments and agencies. It's impossible for any one individual to have this many agencies and have them conducted properly and operated correctly without some control. What we are proposing is to reorganize the state departments into 10 separate agencies and have them all listed categorically under these different agencies so that we will have complete change of command. We will eliminate the duplication and all of the other unnecessary waste and expenses. A natural result of having these agencies, we found as many as 5 or 6 different agencies studying the same problem. Without knowledge that the other agencies were investigating, were studying the same thing.
Governor, in the seconds we have left, what does this talk about the possibility of no second Chesapeake Bay Bridge?
Well, as you know, the bids came in about 17% in excess of the estimated cost. This is one of the things we discussed earlier, the increased cost of construction. The money that was appropriated for the bridge and the tunnel is there. If the bids exceed that, you just can't build. But I don't think this is going to happen. The state road is presently negotiating with the low bidder to reduce the bid to bring it within the fiscal feasibility of building.